Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, January 7th, 2018. Peter, 2019. Those fresh women who've just been elected to Congress, just sworn in last week, they are really shaking up Washington, and I could not be more delighted. So, Rashida Tlaib, who is the Palestinian-American from Detroit, she made waves last week when at a Move On rally, she said she had told her son she is going into Congress to, referring to Trump, impeach the motherfucker. And, of course, we've had all kinds of titters and clucking across the country. She was called out by a Christian publication as a foul-mouthed Islamic congresswoman. Trump says that she shamed the nation and her family. And, of course, this is the man who has no shame, who has brought so much shame to the office of president through his own name-calling, shithole countries, the way he belittles people. I mean, everybody knows that this is theater on Trump's part. His mock outrage, using a term that he has frequently used. But it did open up a whole lot of discussion about impeachment, whether you call him an MF or not. And, of course, Nancy Pelosi said, well, you know, I don't really like that language, but I'm not in the business of censorship. But the real reaction of the Democrats is fear that public pressure, egged on by these fresh women who don't have the experience, who have not been properly groomed for corporate political jobs, then they're going to mess things up for the corporate Democrats. So I'm pleased to see this. It is off script, and it does get attention. And we've seen a spate of articles. Over the weekend, Robert Reich, this is the first of two citations of the former Clinton Labor Secretary. His weekly syndicated column is headlined, Trump Must Be Removed to Preserve Our Democracy. No argument there. I've supported impeachment since before the MF was sworn in. And David Leonhardt, who is a neoliberal war hawk, who has written for the New York Times for many years, in a lengthy piece that they gave quite prominent treatment in the Sunday Review section of the New York Times. He writes, the people versus Donald Trump. He is demonstrably unfit for office. What are we waiting for? And this full-page jump goes through various issues that you and I have covered. Obstruction of justice, subverted democracy. Now, of course, I don't embrace everything that Leonhardt argues here, but I think it does show that there is a broad spectrum of support for impeachment at this point. Now to my second citation of Robert Reich. In a Guardian op-ed published today, he warns that while he supports Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats who have taken control of the House, that they will do little to slow or reverse the growing imbalance of wealth and power in this country unless they are pushed to do so. Do not, he says, ever underestimate the influence of Wall Street Democrats, corporate Democrats, and their biggest funders. He says, I know. I've been there. And he goes into some detail here about his concerns. Democrats' moneyed interests don't want more powerful labor unions. They're not in favor of stronger antitrust enforcement against large corporations. They resist firmer regulation of Wall Street. They are unlikely to want to repeal the Trump tax cut for big corporations and the wealthy. And they are opposed to increasing the federal debt, which he sees as the genesis of Pelosi's embrace of the conservative pay-go measure. But here's the critical one. When it comes to impeaching Trump, some of the Democrats' biggest funders worry that such a move might rile markets. They are counseling the House Democratic leadership to be cautious, even when it comes to smaller acts of defiance, such as subpoenaing Trump's tax returns. So this is going to be the real test of the next 2 years. Will the outspoken progressives like Tlaib and Ocasio-Cortez, among others, will they be able to push the leadership of their party away from their corporate funders and into leadership for the country. And clearly, even if impeachment comes up short, I believe it is demanded by the information that we have so far. And critically, Michael Cohen's guilty plea names Donald Trump as the guy who told him to commit those crimes. And as Leonhard said, what are we waiting for? Now, Rashida Tlaib also generated headlines when she retweeted a comment from Bernie Sanders. And this is something I fully support both Sanders and Tlaib on. Sanders tweeted, "It's absurd that the first bill during the shutdown is legislation which punishes Americans who exercise their constitutional right to engage in political activity. Democrats must block consideration of any bills that don't reopen the government." Now, Bernie isn't explicit there. What he's talking about is the new legislation that failed in the last session to prevent me and you and others from embracing boycott, divestment, and sanction campaigns aimed at the state of Israel. And so I want you to listen carefully as I read Tlaib's comment that she added to Sanders' tweet. And I ask you to think critically. Is she being anti-Semitic in this expression? So she wrote, "They forgot what country they represent. This is the U.S., where boycotting is a right and part of our historical fight for freedom." You know, like the original Tea Party? She doesn't say that. I'm adding that. "Maybe a refresher on our U.S. Constitution is in order. Then get back to opening up our government instead of taking our rights away." But a man named Howard Lovey, who I'm not familiar with, tweeted in response, "Not a week into it, and Rashida Tlaib is already invoking the old anti-Semitic dual loyalty garbage. There are many things wrong with anti-BDS legislation, but when the first thing she raises is the ancient specter of Jewish disloyalty, you know this is going to be a rough ride." Now, I consider that to be a really bizarre response to what she tweeted. And I think it exposes the mindset that is quick to label anything that is uncomfortably critical of the Jewish state as anti-Semitic. And I deeply resent this. Now, I don't know exactly what kind of mental state produces this. All Tlaib said was, this is our country. We have a constitution. And I believe she's referring to the First Amendment. I don't think she's trying to claim that Jews have dual loyalty. But if that's what his interpretation is, then I have to say that we're in a really deep spot. We can't rationally discuss these things because the defenders of Israel immediately revert to the poison pill. Supporting free expression and the right to boycott, they consider to be just flatly anti-Semitic. And they persuaded a lot of non-Jews to that point of view. So now the federal bill is Senate Bill 1. The author is Marco Rubio. He's taken over for the Ben Cardin, who was the Democrat who sponsored it in the last Senate session. And it's very similar. It will penalize people who embrace BDS. And it's flatly unconstitutional. That is my firm belief. But Rubio's bill was co-sponsored by Democrats like Bob Menendez of New Jersey, Manchin of West Virginia, Cardin, who wrote the bill last year, he's from Maryland, Ron Wyden of Oregon, who's generally more progressive than this. I hope our Oregonians will let him know that this is out of bounds. Gary Peters and Debbie Stabenow of Michigan. And so this form of protectionism, carving out an exception in the First Amendment for the state of Israel, was deeply offensive. Even in Arkansas, the ACLU sent me a column that was written by the editor of the Arkansas Times. I've linked to it, and I encourage you to read it. In part, it says, "You know, it had never occurred to us to boycott anyone. But the idea that the state of Arkansas would force a publishing company to take a political position in return for business was offensive. What was at issue? Advertising from the University of Arkansas in the newspaper. And at first they said, you got to sign this pledge not to support BDS. Then they offered them a 20% discount. They said, you don't have to sign the pledge, just cut your rate by 20%. And the editor said, well, to hell with them. We're not going to pay a 20% tax for the right to hold beliefs independent of the Arkansas legislature, not without a fight. And he says, we're focused on Arkansas at the Arkansas Times and have never editorially advocated for a boycott of Israel. But as journalists, citizens, and taxpayers, we dispute the right of the state to impose any ideological litmus test on a publisher or other business. He closes by saying, this law is a rabbit hole our country does not need to go down. Since when do American citizens have to pledge to act in the interest of a foreign power? Well, wait a minute. Isn't he shaming Jews and their dual loyalty with that remark? Isn't this anti-Semitic? I'm getting so tired of that. Retrograde argument. Now, the other darling among the fresh women in Congress was featured as the lead interview subject on CBS 60 Minutes last night. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I thought, did fairly well. Anderson Cooper tried to bait her with questions about socialism, and he acted like the conscience of the nation, appalled that somebody would advocate socialism. And this morning I heard Rush Limbaugh chewing over the same stuff, and he just freely equates socialism and communism, because that serves the interests of the capitalists. Oh, Americans are terribly allergic to communism, and as a state authoritarian approach to socialism, it was a failure, and I am not a communist. But I do support socialism as the offset to unbridled capitalism. And guess who came to the defense of AOC when she suggested, over the cluck-cluck of Anderson Cooper, that she supports a top tax rate of 70%, like we had before Reagan lowered it. And guess who came to her support? I can't believe this is the second podcast in a row that I'm quoting Paul Krugman of the New York Times, also a professor of economics at Princeton. But he says that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez gets it right, that the U.S. had one of the most successful periods of economic growth in our history after World War II, when the top tax rate was 70%. Then he quotes Nobel Prize-winning economist Diamond, and another guy too, a woman, says this guy Diamond says the optimal U.S. tax rate is 73%. Christina Romer, former advisor to Obama, estimates that it's over 80%. And then Krugman goes through the economic arguments, and he makes them in academic terms, and then he simplifies it for you and me. He says a policy that makes the rich a bit poorer will affect only a handful of people and will barely affect their life satisfaction, since they'll still be able to buy whatever they want. And he says when taxing the rich, all we should care about is how much revenue we raise. The optimal tax rate on people with high incomes is the rate that raises the maximum possible revenue. So, he says, AOC, far from showing her craziness, is fully in line with serious economic research. And then he goes on to debunk the Republican claims that there is research that supports tax cuts. He said this claim rests on research by, well, nobody. So, I've linked to Krugman's column. You can check it out for yourselves. The link is in the show file at peterbcollins.com. The other interview that I watched on 60 Minutes last night was with the Egyptian military dictator, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. And they made a big show of asking him a lot of tough questions about the dissidents that he has locked up, tortured, consigned to death in group trials. Yeah, they exposed the abuses of el-Sisi. But in recounting the recent history of Egypt, following the Arab Spring, the ejection of Mubarak, the election of Mohamed Morsi, And then they talk about how Morsi became unpopular. They claim he was a dogmatic, extreme Islamist, and I don't see any evidence of that. Then they said there were street protests, and boom, Al-Sisi took over. And while Steve Croft did challenge the legitimacy of Al-Sisi, he didn't use that simple four-letter word, C-O-U-P. No, he couldn't bring himself to say that Al-Sisi grabbed power in a military coup. But what's fascinating is, for the first time that I can recall, in a news column at the New York Times over a dispute between the Egyptians and CBS, they didn't want this interview run because Al-Sisi blurted out a bunch of stuff about how he's collaborating with Israel and allowing them to conduct military operations in the Sinai. And they wanted to censor that. Now, to its credit, CBS refused. But get this. The New York Times, like I said, for the first time I can recall, refers to, quote, cooperation has grown far closer since the military coup that brought Sisi to power in 2013. So the Times has finally come to terms with it. But 60 Minutes, oh, they can't say that word coup. Maybe they're thinking of car with two doors, you know? So John Bolton has been dispatched to the Middle East to clean up the mess that Trump created with his pre-Christmas tweet about pulling our troops out of Syria pronto. And let me offer my own apology, because I kind of believed Trump. I thought he was serious about pulling troops out. And Gareth Porter showed us that this was not the overnight surprise that the Pentagon and others claimed it was, that Trump has been talking about this for months. And so you do have my formal apology.
Excuse me.
So Bolton stopped off in Israel, had dinner with Netanyahu, told reporters that American forces will remain in Syria until the last remnants of the Islamic State are defeated, and Turkey provides guarantees that it won't strike Kurdish forces allied with the United States. Bolton quoted, "We don't think the Turks ought to undertake military action that's not fully coordinated with and agreed to by the United States." Now, what's the basis for this? We are not invited to have troops in Syria, but we are setting terms for a neighboring nation? Now, I have a lot of problems with Turkey and their desire to vanquish the Kurds, and the U.S. willingness, apparently, to allow that to happen. But Bolton has seriously walked back Trump's claims and added so many qualifiers that this is once again an open-ended commitment of allegedly 2,000 U.S. troops to remain in Syria indefindly. Lindsey Graham said the president's slowing down, reevaluating his policies in light of these three objectives. Don't let Iran get the oil fields, don't let the Turks slaughter the Kurds, and don't let the Islamic State come back. So Trump is allowing himself to be a tool of the very deep state and the people that he has been struggling with to try to articulate his own foreign policy. And so it just shows you cannot believe a single thing that that guy utters or tweets. And now the qualification coming is that the U.S. plans to withdraw about half of the 14,000 troops deployed in Afghanistan, but the special ops forces will remain in the country to continue to strike missions against the Taliban and alleged elements of the Islamic State in Afghanistan. So it's forever, baby. We're going to be in Afghanistan for the foreseeable future, and we're not pulling out of Syria. Every day I pause for a moment to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And I paid a visit to the P.O. Box over the weekend. John Zweibel has committed to $10 a month. He's putting it in the mail. He doesn't like PayPal. Thank you, John. I really appreciate that. I got a card from the Mazzies, and Brian and Gina have a new baby girl, Abigail, born on December 12th. Congratulations, Brian. And a little holiday extra cash. I really appreciate that. Also, Paul Elsesser, like clockwork on the first of every month, is kicking in his contribution to support the PBC podcast. Craig Daniels, who alerted me to some problems at the P.O. box that have clearly been fixed. He's up in North Bend, Oregon, and I got your letter. He let me know that he can add a few bucks because he got a break on his Medicare bill. And a great letter, as usual, at the end of the year from Del Leonard, our vice president for marketing. He's based in Maine, and I got a chance to meet him last summer when I was out there on vacation. And he kicked in extra bucks, and we have some scholarships that are available. If you would like a subscription and you don't have the means to pay for it, all you have to do is email Peter at peterbcollins.com, and I'll be happy to set you up. I have never turned anybody down who asked for a scholarship to the Peter B. Collins podcast. And those of you who are able to contribute, it's your turn. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click menu, click become a subscriber, puts you on the sign-up page. And if you're like Zweibel and you don't want to use PayPal, you can address your correspondence and your contributions to Box 150, 660, San Rafael, California, 94915. Rutrow, I said, Trump's going to give one of those wooden teleprompter speeches. He's asked the networks for prime time on Tuesday. And when you couple this with his threat over the weekend to declare a national emergency in order to build his border wall. Yeah, he floated this the other day on Friday. And there is a law, the National Emergencies Act of 1976, that says presidents are allowed to take unilateral action in times of crisis, provided they notify Congress, specify the circumstances that necessitated the declaration, and document all uses of executive authority that are covered by the emergency. So, is he going to get hysterical? Is he going to trot out PowerPoints from the border and declare that this is such a crisis and Congress is refusing to act? And so, he's not going to reopen the government. No. He is going to claim he has the authority, I guess, to order the military. He claimed he called U.S. Steel to order some fencing materials made in America. So just be prepared. I don't know what he's got up his sleeve, but you know he is desperate to prove that there is a need for his wall. Or he's now calling it a steel barrier. He claims the Democrats don't like concrete, so we'll give them steel. And get this, Mick Mulvaney claims that that change in language is such a big move by Trump. It's a concession. He said if he has to give up a concrete wall, replace it with a steel fence in order to do that, so the Democrats can say, see, he's not building a wall anymore. That should help us move in the right direction, Mulvaney said. Yeah. Right. The public will never figure out that kind of an effort to buffalo us. As you may know, I am a big fan of the journalism work of Max Blumenthal. And over at the Gray Zone Project, together with a new writing partner, Mohammed El-Mazi, they disclose fascinating information about Britain's Integrity Initiative that is run by an outfit registered in Scotland called the Institute for Statecraft. Now, before I get into the nuts and bolts of this, I want to jump to the end of the article, because El-Mazi went to visit the London headquarters of this military-funded propaganda arm of the British government. And he was rebuffed and turned away. But on December 11th, 5 days after El-Mazi visited, another reporter, Kit Clarenberg of Sputnik Radio, went to visit the same office. And he was angrily ejected by the Institute of Statecraft staffer, whose name is Simon Bracey Lane. Now, I never heard of the guy before, but it turns out in 2016, Mr. Bracey Lane appeared out of nowhere and volunteered as a field organizer for the Bernie Sanders for President campaign. Now, according to documents that hackers released and that are published by the Gray Zone Project and Max Blumenthal in this fascinating report, Bracey Lane is the subject of a document where it is reported that he is an expert on U.S. elections and that he wrote a report on the 2016 campaign including, apparently, his participation. So this is not a smoking gun, but it is a fascinating link. And Blumenthal promises to do more investigation of Simon Bracey Lane and his role in the Sanders campaign. Now, the big story here is that this integrity initiative and the Institute for Statecraft, they show how it is used to run information operations. And I think this stems from Blumenthal's investigation into the smearing of Jeremy Corbyn as an anti-Semite. And it appears that this may have come from the British intelligence operation. He also shows, through these documents, that the British were able to squelch a nomination by the government of Spain to promote Pedro Baños to director of the National Security Department. But they immediately, on hearing of this nomination, spread the word that he was pro-Kremlin. They carried out the hit job through a hand-picked cluster of Spanish politicians and operatives, and Baños' nomination was withdrawn. So these documents brag about some of the operations that they have conducted. And what's fascinating is they track down the official headquarters address of the Institute of Statecraft and find it to be an abandoned and partly demolished set of buildings in Fife, Scotland, at an old mill. And that kind of mirrors some of the covert operations by the U.S. CIA, where they have these dead drops and post office boxes that are listed in official papers related to front organizations. We'll continue to watch that, and I'll signal Max Blumenthal and try to get a fresh interview with him in the near future. New information has surfaced from the New York Times about a second false flag operation funded by Democrats in the narrow election that defeated Roy Moore and brought Doug Jones to the United States Senate in the special election to replace Jeff Sessions back in 2017. The new false flag campaign was a Facebook operation called Dry Alabama. Alcohol is the devil's work, they argued, and this was, they thought, a sophisticated effort to peel off certain Republican voters and get them to abandon Roy Moore. And Matt Osborne from New Knowledge, the organization that the New York Times cited as credible when it claimed its analysis showed that Russian operatives manipulated black voters and suppressed black voter turnout in 2016. As you know, I find that far-fetched and a cover for the voter suppression operations that did suppress black turnout or apparent turnout in 2016. And when you dig into this, there is not a word in the New York Times report by Scott Shane and Alan Blinder mentioning that New Knowledge was the source of these claims that are now treated as fact by many people, that Russia did interfere in ways that manipulated black voters. So this is a fascinating piece, and the Times is curiously unwilling to really investigate its own published claims based on information from New Knowledge. But they do break down this operation, and they claim that it originated at a Netroots Nation progressive gathering. Now, I've been to a couple of Netroots Nations, and of course, it's an offshoot of the Daily Kos. It's basically a meeting of tech-savvy young political operatives of the Democratic stripe. They're all insiders to the what I consider to be the centrist wing of the Democratic Party. And so the Dry Alabama came out of discussions at Netroots Nation, and the summation here is that the people who are tagged in Alabama as business conservative Republicans, well, they're drinkers. But culture war conservatives favor dry. So they decided to try to scare the business conservatives into voting for the Democrat by claiming that Roy Moore would cut off their booze in Alabama. Now, these are dirty tricks. And the people who did them are claiming, well, yeah, we're kind of embarrassed by this, but it's not against the law. because the law hasn't caught up with the internet yet. Wow. Rationalizations, that's all those are. And it cuts again into the Trump-Russia narrative that's been promoted by the Democratic Party as the excuse for Hillary Clinton's loss. Well, the Mueller grand jury just got a six-month extension, so that investigation is not going to be over anytime soon. And with the Democrats taking over the House Intelligence Committee and the new chairman, Southern California Congressman Adam Schiff, he is sharing the transcripts of all the witness interviews that the panel conducted while the Republicans ran it, and he expects Robert Mueller to find issues of perjury around prominent members of the Trump family and Trump's inner circle. I want to recommend a piece at The Hill today under the byline of John Solomon, one of the founders of this political outlet, and he is breaking news for the first time about information that is potentially exculpatory to Mike Flynn. Now, I've taken some heat from some of my listeners who think I was too nice to Mike Flynn and suggested that he may have been set up. And when you understand this background, I think it supports that theory. So, before Mike Flynn went to Moscow in December of 2015 to the infamous dinner where he sat at a table next to Putin, and it was to honor RT and Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, was at the same table. Well, before he went, he alerted his former employer, the Defense Intelligence Agency. He attended a defensive or protective briefing before he left. The briefing educated and sensitized Flynn to possible efforts by the Russian host to compromise him. And when he returned from Moscow, he spent time being debriefed. So, while this was made out to be this mysterious meeting where Mike Flynn picked up cash and got free first-class airfare for himself and his son to Moscow, his attendance was disclosed in advance. He took proactive steps to ensure that he couldn't be compromised. And then he came back and reported to the U.S. Intelligence Committee, community. And so, again, I'm no fan of Mike Flynn, and I think that his brazen acceptance of cash from intermediaries on behalf of the state of Turkey and their effort to repatriate Fethullah Gulen, that was a dirty deed, and I can't understand why Mueller has let him off. Glenn Greenwald is back on the Trump-Russia case, kind of tangentially. Today he is attacking NBC and MSNBC for their gross media malpractice. First, you need to know that on Friday, and this story was buried in Saturday's New York Times, two scientists presented evidence that the sonic attack on U.S. diplomats in Cuba that was variously described as some kind of an advanced microwave weapon or something that we have never seen before, it turns out that it was crickets. And I'm not using that as a metaphor. The scientists said that the sound audio file that was analyzed, that had been given to the Associated Press, he says, all I can say fairly definitively is that the AP released recording is of a cricket, and we know that is the Indies short-tailed cricket. Now, there are many other possibilities here. I don't have scientific proof that that is the only explanation. But there is no proof of the far-fetched explanations, including the microwave weapon and NBC and MSNBC's reports in September of 2018 that Russia is the main suspect in what the network called the mysterious attacks that led to, quote, brain injuries in U.S. personnel in Cuba. And Greenwald sharpens his focus on MSNBC employee Ken Delanian. And he's been outed before as a shill for the CIA, a real pipeline, a stenographer, and not a journalist. And let me just cite one of the broadcasts that Glenn Greenwald includes with video links in his article. One six-minute segment led by Andrea Mitchell, who began the report by announcing that intelligence officials now believe that Russia is the leading suspect and it was no accident. Well, this is just one example of how MSNBC went way off the rails with speculative reporting and claimed it as fact. And in recent weeks, what we are seeing is that with the arrest of this guy, Paul Whelan, or Whelan, the Detroit guy who's being held as a spy in Moscow, that they already consider him a hostage. They don't explore the possibility that he was spying for somebody or that he broke Russian laws. And they clearly see a setup for an exchange with Maria Butina or Butina. And that's certainly a possibility, but Mueller is planning to release her down the line. I don't think the Russians need to rescue her. But that's where it stands today. And finally, here in California, we had a change of the guard 1 hour and 37 minutes ago. Jerry Brown is no longer the governor here. After four terms, interrupted by, 25 years in between, he has formally retired as governor of California. And Gavin Newsom, his young, telegenic replacement, was sworn in as governor today. And I just want to share with you yesterday's front page of the San Francisco Chronicle. They celebrated all of the accomplishments of Jerry Brown. And then they talked about the big challenges, all the things that Jerry Brown didn't fix while he was governor. And those are all now Gavin Newsom's responsibility. Thanks for joining me today for my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the damn place. And you'll find it on YouTube. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.